Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down, Griffin.
It's sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day there, it's Mark Kenny here with another Democracy Sausage, which comes to you each week from the Australian National University. And with me, as often, as almost always is the case, is Dr. Maria Tiflaga, political scientist at the School of Politics and International Relations. Hi there, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm going well. I'm going very well. It's been an interesting week, actually, seeing politics play out in a range of ways, as is always the case. But we're going to be talking today about a longer run issue, which might in some ways seem premature, and that is the risk that the government faces of being a one term government, which raises that whole question, which comes up often in political coverage and political discussions in Australia, in the reporting and so forth, that Australia is not a place that has one-term governments. I know as a columnist and journalist, I've made this point myself. You know, the last one-term government was the Scullin government, 29 to 31. Every other federal governments here that I'm talking about anyway. Every other government gets at least another term. Notwithstanding that a lot of people think that elections are, you know, 50-50 every time and so forth. So that doesn't imply that what we're saying is that this current government faces, loss at the next election inevitably, but neither does it imply, and that's what our guest is going to talk to us about, that that you can't lose at the after just one term. So perhaps I'll bring in our guest now. Bill Brown is director of the Democracy and Accountability Program at the Australia Institute, as distinct from the Australian Studies Institute, from whence I come. Bill, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thanks for having me.
It's terrific. Now, you've actually done some work on this, haven't you? You've looked at this this question about one-term governments. What does your research show?
That's right. We've gone back 100 years and looked at state and territory and federal governments to see just how prevalent one-term governments are. And while they're the exception, for sure, it's not true that they're impossible by any means. In fact, we seem to be living in an era where there are unusually many one-term governments. There's been four in the last 10 years, and you have to go back to roughly the Great Depression era to have so many one-term governments in a 10-year period.
Yeah, so just to be clear here, we're talking about state and federal governments in this category because, as per my original point, we've still only got one since the First World War, or shortly after it. It was the Great Depression, which saw off the Wall Street crash and so forth, which saw off the Scullin government in 1931, and we haven't seen federally another government get just one term. But you're sort of talking about them, federal and state, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's been a few near misses at the federal level, but as you say, just the one that's actually ended up as a one-term government. And yeah, we've extended that analysis to like take a look at the state level as well, where they're somewhat more frequent, although again, there's been long periods with no one-term government in any particular state.
So, Bill, I'm curious to know, I mean, like one of the reasons why the Scullin government lost in 32 was not only that they were living through the biggest economic calamity since the 1890s recession, which was also like worse than the Great Depression for nerds out there that want to know these kinds of things, but that government split, right? Like, you know, and then they had like Jack Lang also, you know, doing crazy stuff in New South Wales, you know, potentially refusing to pay debts. Like people were seriously worried about, you know, the future of like governance in general in Australia. It was petty times. Mm. But what's the sort of, I imagine that is not necessarily always the driving factor in some of these subnational state elections. What are the kinds of trends that you've identified that might explain those one-term governments?
So the first one that's worth noting is this idea of federal drag, that it's harder for a state government to get re-elected if the same party is in government at the federal level. Either there's a bit of a transfer of issues, so people blame the state government for the federal government, or they want to balance things out and bring a bit of evenness to kind of government across the country at the different levels. And that's likely to be a factor in these recent elections as well. They're all coalition governments that only made it one term at a time when the coalition was in power federally. But of course, federal drag has been an issue for a long time, and this is an unusually large number of one-term governments. I think another factor to consider is the small government agenda adopted by a lot of the coalition governments as they've come in, and in some cases, very ambitious agendas. For example, the Campbell-Newman government, which saw a very substantial swing against it after just one term, and Labor rallying from a handful of seats to getting very close to a majority, enough to win government, had an ambitious privatization agenda that involved selling off electricity assets, ports, and so on. And the evidence seems to be that the public didn't accept that, and they're reluctant to see such dramatic changes at the state level. Part of the explanation for that might be that it's the states that provide services like health and education that need to be funded.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. And I was just thinking that as you were coming to the conclusion of that answer, that the, you know, it's long been kind of observable in Australian politics that Labor has done better at the state level around the place than at the federal level. And this is often described as voters wanting, you know, trusting Labor to do things like run schools, hospitals, public transport systems, these sorts of things, you know, the services that are sort of directly provided by government, overseen by government. And they're looking for, you know, the coalition's perceived strengths for overall national leadership, economic management, and these sorts of things. That seems to be consistent with your numbers here, doesn't it?
It does seem to be, yeah. And it'd be an interesting follow-up to look at some of the federal systems around the world and see if they have a similar trend. I know in Canada, for example, it's the federal government that's more likely to be left-wing than right-wing. But as a whole, I think that goes some way to explaining this phenomenon that you've got national security and, I guess, management of the economy as a whole as a federal issue versus that provision of services mostly at the state level.
Maria, we've seen in elections in recent years, you know, there's often talk about voters voting differentially between the House and the Senate. You know, this idea that I'm prepared to go with one party there, but I'm going to check their power in the Senate. I mean, I'm never entirely convinced by these arguments, whether people are coming to these rationales. It's a bit hard to know. But it sort of sounds from what Bill's saying that same kind of logic might have been determining the way people vote between state and federal as well, that if there is a coalition government federally, which for more years than not has been the case, then they go for the other party in the state at the state level, so they don't have too much uniformity, one party doesn't have too much control over them. Again, you know, notwithstanding what we're just saying about service delivery and the like.
Yeah, okay. So That is very interesting. And I would say a couple of things about this. The first is that it is actually interesting to me that in this country we really don't understand why people vote in state elections. Like, we don't have the equivalent of the Australian Electoral Study for state elections. And so a lot of
which is the study that comes out of ANU, which has been running since the 1970s, I think.
Yeah, since 1987, but there were previous like the first one that we can link to goes back to 1969, which we do. And that is interesting in of itself. Because so everything that I'm about to sort of say is what I would put in the basket of hypothesis, and I would like some data to test this. But I guess these are the things that sort of come out at me when I think about these things. So I do think there is a slightly different dynamic that plays out with the Senate. Again, this is something I don't think we truly understand. Then with the states, I think the reason why people differentiate between the reps, the lower house, and the upper chamber is because the voting system logics of the two election the two chambers are actually different. One is basically a type of first past the post, and the other is or a majoritarian system rather, and the other one is a proportional system. And voters have slowly kind of worked out that they can achieve different democratic kind of norms. What's potentially going on with, like, I have a lot of sympathy for this argument that voters actually do understand the difference between the federal and state government, mm-hmm. and that they understand that there are different interests at play. And, you know, and to a degree, I think the parties understand this too. And there's so much tension in politics now at the federal level because voters want the federal government, who has all the money. I think voters seem to understand this because the state governments have been blaming the federal government for a lack of money since, you know, Menzies took away their – oh, sorry, was it Menzies? No, it was the Curtin government that took away their taxation powers during the Second World War, right? So I think voters know the federal government has the power, and the federal government has the problem of being tasked with the requirement to resolve issues in health and education but they actually don't have the ability to control these systems. And what is actually most kind of interesting to me – going on what you said, Bill, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about this, which is like looking at you've got a list here, a lovely list of the names of these governments and when they were kind of – when they lost, right? And so that we see a blob in the years leading up to the Depression and inclusive of the Depression, and then we see another sort of – we see little pockets of it all kind of centered around big economic shocks. So we've got the oil crisis and we've got the 1983 recession. And then, you know, we've got a huge kind of – we've got a growing trend of governments happening to governments in the last 10 years. And to me, part of it is like obviously just crisis, and we have a typical economic voting explanation that might drive this, you know, simply that voters punish governments for poor economic performance. And so, you know, Liz Truss should be very, very worried. She's probably going to get a lesson in economic voting very soon. But the other is – prediction called. The other is that, you know, if we also look at these dates, we can kind of see that they're at those what we'd call in political science speak, the sort of punctuated equilibrium of a policy cycle. And that's a fancy way of saying, like, the opportunity space for doing something different is opening. And so this might also be why – the federal drag might become a bigger issue because, you know, one party is offering one set of solutions at the federal level, really calling up into relief the alternative strategy of the other government at the subnational level. And if that's involving, you know, making smaller government when a trend towards smaller government has been the norm for a long time, you could see that voters might not want more of the same, and definitely not more doubling down like the Campbell Newman government or the Baillieu government did. And so they might basically, you know, say, I'm not going to give you another chance. I'm going to get rid of you. So that would be my theory. So whether or not that bears out remains to be seen.
Thoughts, Bill?
I think, you've definitely hit on something there, and it's something we've talked about as well at the Australia Institute in terms of the response to COVID, which is that we've seen a distinct strategy from the states emerge and a kind of leadership role played by state premiers and chief ministers. involving a more substantial government response. And the federal government, to some extent, left trailing behind that state response. From polling that we did last year that tracked people's evaluation of state and federal governments, we also saw that ability to distinguish between the two of them. So I think you're right there as well, that voters are pretty sophisticated and are able to at least some extent, pinpoint where policy leadership is coming from. Another example is climate change, where the states and territories led the federal government towards a net zero target. And in fact, the whole country had a net zero target, but via eight different jurisdictions before we arrived at one at the federal level. So there's an opportunity for leadership from the states as a reaction to the unusual times that we find ourselves in. Having reviewed the one-term governments through history, I think you're right that crisis has often been a contributor. There's also just some noise in the data. So elections can be very close-run things. In the majoritarian system that we have, you can also lose the popular vote but win a majority of the seats, which complicates any kind of attempt to identify the popular will for a government to survive or to come to an end. And in the Great Depression era as well, we've got some of the preliminaries of our party system still being worked out. So the coalition agreement was still new, and a number of those governments that collapsed, in some cases collapsed twice, it was Labour and Country Party, what would become the National Party, coalitions falling apart. With the formalisation of the coalition agreement, something like that is much less likely to happen today. But I think you're right to point to crisis as a key reason why many of these governments didn't make it.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage, which comes to you from the Australian National University, as I'm sure you already know. We're talking about one-term governments here with Bill Brown and Maria Taflago, and we're covering off, a number of aspects of this. One of the things that I'd like to introduce into it is just the whole notion of volatility that has come into politics generally. This touches on some of the themes we've already mentioned in terms of the adherence to new and sometimes quite unpopular policies. You mentioned, Maria, for example, Campbell Newman's privatisations and so forth, things that have become great negatives and which have seen dramatic electoral swings. You know, the recovery of Labor in Queensland from not being able to field a cricket team to getting a majority in one term, I think it was, extraordinary. So, but, you know, there's a sort of a sense that the kind of tempo of swings in the political climate has increased over recent times. And if that is the case, then I guess we shouldn't be surprised that we're starting to see more one-term governments. And, of course, measured against the sort of 2.5 to 3 year cycle of the federal government, we've got seven other jurisdictions going to, I mean, admittedly, you know, 3 and 4 year cycles, but, you know, going to elections as well. So there's a lot more of them collectively than there are of the federal one. But Bill, do you think volatility helps explain some of this? Just a more volatile, a more sort of more mercurial electorate and political discourse?
I think so. And I think you can see that not just in changes of government, but also changes of leadership. So we've had a relatively long coalition government at the federal level until this year, but with multiple changes of leadership. And Australia's other enduring government in New South Wales is on to its fourth premier. So there as well, you've got multiple measures of volatility, and a few of them are showing up as quite volatile. I think part of that you'd have to think is the ongoing legacy of the global financial crisis. And then more recently, COVID has played a role as well. It's helped some governments win whopping majorities, even though they've been in power for a while, but it's also been linked to the troubles that the Marshall government had that kept it to one term.
That's a really extraordinary case, the Marshall government, because no one thought it was a terrible government. I mean, there were people, obviously some voters hated it and so forth, as is always the case. You know, there are people who are committed one way or the other in politics as voters, and that's perfectly reasonable. But objectively speaking, it wasn't a terrible government. It was one that where the Premier was to some extent under siege from right-wingers within the South Australian Liberal Party, and the South Australian Liberal Party is famously riven with this kind of thing. I speak as a former South Australian. But it was nonetheless a basically competent government in a basically stable economic situation that hit the fence, up against a very charismatic and very focused Peter Malinauskas-led Labor Party. It is a state that has a history, sort of a, it seems to me like its resting position is basically a Labor state. But nonetheless, a really extraordinary achievement for Labor to do that. And Labor had done that before. Labor did it with the Tonkin government between, I think it was 79 and 82. 82, John Bannon won the election there, and then there was a, you know, virtually a dozen years of Labor then as well. One-term governments aren't, even though that's a pretty sort of conservative, like as in stable polity, the South Australian polity, I think its sort of resting position is essentially as a Labor voting state. So every now and then a government runs out of puff, the Libs get one term, and then they get turfed out again. Must be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you might be able to draw an analogy to the Baillieu-Napthine government in Victoria as well, which again only lasted a term coming in after a long-standing Labor government, and in Queensland as well.
And that was a case, the Baillieu-Napthine government was a case of changing leaders, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And so changing leaders can be a factor. And we've seen, you touched on this, Bill, but we've seen a lot of that in politics in recent years. And I was just thinking, you know, because I've made this, as I said at the start, I've made this observation about one-term governments federally being very rare. But the other thing I've often said is that whilst they are rare, and I think you've made reference to this as well, Bill, whilst they're rare, governments facing re-election for the first time are also very vulnerable, and it's quite common for them to actually go backwards. So if we think about Hawke in 84, like he wins in 83 and then goes backwards in 84, Howard wins in 96, goes backwards in 98, in fact loses the popular vote quite decisively but manages to cling on. Labor, of course, wins big in 2007, but then goes backwards in 2010, having changed leader. And then Abbott wins a thumping majority in 2013, and the coalition goes to is reduced to a one-seat majority, having again changed leaders. So yeah, really, if you're in opposition and you've just gone out of power, you'd be crazy to be thinking we can't come back here, because it hasn't happened very often at the federal level. It's not much difference between getting within, sort of just losing and just winning.
There's actually a bit of a pattern, as you say, of going backwards at your first bid for re-election. Professor Murray Goot has done a breakdown of federal elections since, I think, 1931, perhaps since World War II, and found that that's a bit of a pattern. He argues that it's the margin by which most oppositions win government that is what leads to them having at least two terms, not any kind of will of the people to give them a second chance or to give them a proper go of it. And so in that case, you'd have to look at the narrow margin by which the Albanese government won and wonder if that pattern of tending to lose vote at the next election is going to be repeated.
But there's a couple of different ways you could read that, Maria, isn't it? I mean, you could, for example, you could say, one, you have to factor in the fact that a lot of those governments then go on and win a third term, right? So it can't just be what they won if they've gone backwards, but then perhaps increased their majority again the third time round.
So I would say that part of that is sort of like an experience story, but there's also like a trend the other way. And if we look at, state results, we've actually seen this increasing trend of governments like or new governments crashing into minority and then improving their result and winning them a majority in their own right. And so, I guess another to sort of align with Murray Goot's argument, we could sort of say we could potentially interpret this as there is a bit of a correction. Like if you give a new government a thumping majority, well, they'll disappoint you. Maybe you were really sick of the old government and so you get a correction. And then perhaps with in the case of the minority governments that are hungry and work very hard because they're a minority, so they actually have to behave better because they have to actually corral support. Voters like that. And so then they are rewarded, right? But if we were to sort of, I guess, think of some other reasons as to why this trend would happen, and to get really sort of political science-y, like what would be these, like the independent variables, right? The factors that we think might explain this outcome. Well, I think there would be, and you touched on this before, Mark, the media cycle now does seem to be retarding the way that we are able to have positive policy conversations. Like, I think this has actually improved since the truly dark days of the minority parliament, where every conversation was zero sum, and it was simply Abbott was either supporting a policy or he wasn't, and there was really no ability to discuss why.
It wasn't a great period of nuance, was it?
Absolutely not, and I think the way that social media operated at that time meant that everything was geared towards a negative set of conversations. It was really favorable to oppositions. And, as with all new forms of technology, politicians work out how to use them. And we are seeing that there are more positive conversations kind of going on. And the integrity movement is actually, I think, a good case study of that, which I think Bill could probably talk about in a minute. But I'll just give my other two independent variables. And the other one is policy uncertainty, which I talked about before, so I won't go on about that one. But the final one is essentially responsiveness, right? We have really seen in the last sort of 10 years or so, the political system has really struggled to respond to what voters want. We might call this congruence, right? The how much what political actors, elites in parliaments are doing and how much that aligns with what voters actually want. And if you take the last federal government as an example, I think there's actually several policy domains in which they, for their own partisan reasons, their own internal party reasons, or the requirements of a party leader, basically ignored what a public opinion as measured in polls was telling them on several issues, like climate being a really obvious one, but gay marriage being another one, and integrity itself, right? The government was at pains to basically say, we're not going to be doing any of this because it's either a Labor solution or it's not our solution, or, it doesn't suit our internal factional needs, or we don't think it exists, or whatever. And so it doesn't surprise me then that voters who are not being taken, who are being taken for granted, rather, sorry, would basically realize that they actually have the power to chuck them out.
Hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, can I add one further one? And that is, and this is also a variable that hard to measure, but I suspect exists. And that is that governments that are given thumping majorities behave differently from governments that are given only a very small majority. And now that may be quite encouraging for Labor. I remember Mike Rann telling me one time that he had told one of his colleagues from the other states, you have to, who'd won a big majority, he said, govern like you've got a one-seat majority. Because that's, and this probably goes to your point, Mary, about responsiveness, I suppose, as well. If you actually sort of imagine yourself to be governing with a very slim majority, then you will be very careful and very diligent and looking to make sure that everything is done properly. If you've got, like Abbott had, I think it was 90 coalition seats to 55 Labor, the whole party basically thinks, oh, we can't lose the next election. And they end up allowing Abbott to go down various sort of ideological cul-de-sacs, and we saw some particular madness, and then of course a change of leadership.
Yeah, exactly.
Bill,
I think that's quite right, and you see it in a couple of different ways in some of these one-term state and territory governments. So, two of the governments that only made it one term don't have upper houses, Queensland and the Northern Territory. And I think the moderating influence of an upper house elected with a different franchise, probably with crossbenchers in the balance of power, might well have limited some of the overreach that caused those governments so much problems at the election.
It's a very good point. Yeah.
Famously, people attribute the Howard government in 04 to 07 with a similar problem when they won that narrow.
That's exactly
Senate.
What I was thinking when we think about sort of work choices, excesses, and things like that, that Howard was suddenly able to do, having won that election against Mark Latham in 2004 so decisively that he finds himself with that critical 39 votes in the Senate, the 39th vote being a very new Barnaby Joyce in his days in the Senate. And he was able to do things, and those things ended up being big political negatives. They were gifts for Labor. I mean, that was the stuff that Labor was campaigning on in 2007.
I'd like to make this point. You know, I found it really interesting that the sort of popular narrative, I suppose, about the Howard government was that there was like a good Howard government and a bad Howard government, right? You know, the first sort of two terms was a very muscular, reform-oriented Howard government. And then
That's the part with the GST.
Yes, yeah. That's right. The GST, gun control, all of that, you know. And then the second sort of Howard government was from 2001 to 2007, which was, you know, sclerotic and lazy, and, you know, they had money coming out of their ears and so they didn't have to make any tough choices. But you know what I find kind of the irony about this is that, well, yeah, they did win that election in 2004 and won a Senate majority, and then they proceeded to do a series of incredibly radical ideological reforms, and they got absolutely hammered for it. And I actually think it's kind of fascinating that they literally lost on basically introducing radical reforms that were rejected, and yet we say they didn't do anything. I mean, how has that happened?
Yeah, it's a slight contradiction there. Let's just, in the brief few moments we've got left, just go to the integrity question, because I think you've been looking at that as well at the Australia Institute, Bill. It's interesting, isn't it, that the Morrison government sat on its hands for its entire term, having promised to introduce legislation. Labor has, you know, campaigned strongly on this, and of course, as you described it, Maria, the sort of integrity agenda was huge at the last election. It was a very critical part of the election of all of those community independents, and we've now seen legislation introduced, and it seems like the coalition's on board with it. It's quite a fascinating turnaround, and perhaps does say something about Peter Dutton being different from Scott Morrison.
I think the progress on an integrity commission really shows the hunger that's emerged from the public for more accountability from government. And that's played out over a few years. It's only 2018 that we had agreement from either major party and then both major parties to adopt integrity commissions at all. And then, as you say, the delay from the Morrison government was, I think, a real reason for the success of the community independents in those blue ribbon seats, as well as failing to table its proposed integrity commission. The Morrison government was also proposing one that would be much more limited in its powers than what we see is needed from state and territory commissions. And here as well is an example of states and territories leading the way, because again, we had integrity commissions of one form or another in every state and territory, and we're only now moving towards getting one at the federal level.
Yeah, it's a really good point. That process of the states being more responsive. Marie, do you think that reflects, I mean, we talked about, you know, states being deliverers of service and so forth, but it's also true that the state governments are closer to their electors by virtue of that delivery of services. And does that result, do you think, in a more responsive style of government, just like being closer to your electors, smaller electorates, you know, much more intense sort of scrutiny, news coverage in the papers and so forth?
Yeah, so theoretically, I would say that is the case. And I think there's lots of ways we could point to that. Obviously, the kinds of issues that electors would end up in their state MP's office as opposed to their federal MP's office, yeah, might be more sort of bespoke or personal or relating to their personal kind of lives, smaller electorates, that makes these things easier to manage. That said, though, I actually don't know if proportionally state electorates are smaller. I mean, a lot of state houses are significantly smaller than the federal parliament. I think New South Wales is the largest. I think it has around 96 people in the lower house. So maybe New South Welshmen have great representation and maybe that isn't so great at the other levels of government. But, you know, I mean, to be cheeky and provocative, we could say that the states have led the way on integrity, or we could say that the states led the way on corruption and that it took a long time for the federal sphere to develop these problems and that it could be kind of driven off similar things that you've sort of pointed to, Mark, about what makes state politics more responsive, right, and that it's locally driven. Well, that might also make it more vulnerable to corruption, or it could just be the policy domain.
You're absolutely right, and I don't think there's any doubt that that's the case, but that's because the states have had control of planning laws, for example.
Indeed.
Which has been a critical aspect of it.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, so there's no doubt that, you know, controlling, being responsible for running the police, for running the planning system, building codes and all those sorts of things, these are all areas where corruption is rife. And there had long been this kind of discourse in Canberra shared by both sides that there just wasn't any corruption at the federal level, that it was all at the state level. But I do think on the positive side, the electorates are smaller. In some cases, they're like sort of less than half the size of the federal electorates. And people do care about things like their streets and their public transport systems and their hospitals and so forth. And they care about them in a very visceral way because they touch their lives directly
exactly.
In ways that sort of questions of defence or foreign policy or, you know, budget deficits, fiscal policy or whatever tend not to. You know, these are abstracts compared to the other things. So, you know, and as Bill's made the point before, it's not just corruption. Things like in climate action, for example, where we did get to that kind of national net zero target by virtue of all those jurisdictions being much more responsive to community sentiment on that. And we've seen the same thing in, admittedly, it's their purview, it's their province to do this, but we've seen the same thing with much more progressive positions on euthanasia laws, death with dignity and death and these sort of things. So,
yeah, that's absolutely true. And I guess you could say that it might be easier to build those kinds of coalitions for those kinds of reforms in a smaller set of communities. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I was being a bit cheeky because it's fun.
I'm going to give you the final word, Bill.
I think it's true that we are in a period of volatility, but there's reassuring signs as well for the ability of the public to react and to change the course of government. We've seen people demand and expect more of government during the COVID pandemic, and in some cases, government's risen to the occasion. Not always, but there's been a real sense that governments can govern, they can provide for the public. And I think we're actually in an era where we're going to see more of that. We're going to see governments stepping up, doing the things that they do well. And I think that's really reassuring.
It's a really good point to finish on, actually, because it sort of reminds me that, you know, we've had this, and you, I think you've sort of made reference to this, Maria, as well, this sort of whole period of kind of neoliberalism, of the idea of the state withdrawing, of government stepping back, of privatization and so forth. And then COVID's come along. And people have suddenly realized we need government. We need our hospitals to be run properly. We need our social fabric to even function. We need the idea of a social contract of people of the community working together. We're not just units in a market. We're not just consumers or producers or whatever. We're people in a society. And governments are absolutely crucial in the process of maintaining that kind of unity and delivering and protecting a high standard of living and providing for our basic needs.
Absolutely. And just because I really want to tell the listeners, the Australian Political Science Conference has happened recently, and I was in a fascinating paper which surveyed, oversampled rural and regional Australians and had a large sample of, you know, metropolitan Australians. So, you know, a nationally representative sample with an oversampling of people who live in the country. And one of the questions they asked was, who's in a time of natural disaster, which level of government is responsible or should be involved, you know, federal, state, local, or the community? And it didn't matter where people lived, more than 90% of Australians, no matter where they live, thought that each level of government should be involved in a natural disaster. And only about 70 or at most 75% of people thought that it was really the job of the community. And I thought that was like an overwhelming confirmation of an instinct that you know, we've long had about Australians that we do love government and we want government to be involved in our lives. And it kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, Australia was essentially the equivalent of Mars when it was colonized. It was 9 months away, one way. And
I thought you were going to say no one was living there. I was hoping that wasn't where you were going.
No. It would take 9 months to get there on a spaceship to Mars.
And it
took 9 months on a ship one way. And so, you know, state action and state power has been the foundation stone of everything that has built up, you know, white Australia, and that is like a mindset that we have that I don't think any amount of neoliberal turns are necessarily going to shake.
Yeah, and of course we've had the recent experience with the gas crisis through the winter, and very much the fruits of what happens when you devolve assets and allow market mechanisms to determine, you know, fundamental questions of Australia's, you know, property and services. And yes, I think we saw fairly clearly what voters thought of that as well. That's all we've got time for on this Democracy Sausage. Thanks so much, Bill Brown, for coming along, and congratulations on your research, and keep it up.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We'll do so again. And Maria, thank you again.
My pleasure.
Always good. And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week on Democracy Sausage, which, as you know, comes from the Australian National University.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.